Venture 6 deals with tumor responses to radiation therapy. There are many determinants of tumor cure. A number of these are listed here: the size of the clonogenic pool, the intrinsic radiosensitivity of these clonogens, the 4 R's of radiobiology as they relate to fractionated radiation therapy, repair, repopulation, regeneration during therapy, reoxygenation or the extent of hypoxia, redistribution, and in addition, there are a number of factors which relate to heterogeneity. The biological level, the number of clonogenic stem cells in human tumors, or for that matter in animal tumors, is really not very well determined. There are a number of markers available for stem cells, but none of these are absolute. And so it's very difficult to estimate with any accuracy the number of clonogenic stem cells that are within a human tumor. The intrinsic radiosensitivity of these stem cells is obviously important, as is their proliferative potential. And the differentiation status of the other cells, therefore, is also of considerable relevance. As far as the tumor microenvironment is concerned, this is a major factor in introducing heterogeneity to tumors. We tend to think of this in terms of hypoxia, and this is obviously an important determiner of tumor cure. However, there are also many other factors associated with the tumor microenvironment, including the metabolic state of the tumor cells, the number of host cell infiltrating the tumor, and the interstitial pressure within the tumor. Then there's lots of genetic factors. We've already talked about oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes and their potential role as determiners of radiation responsiveness, and also the genetic factors which might come into play. For example, single nucleotide polymorphism, differences between individuals. And at the same time, you shouldn't forget that there is also heterogeneity in terms of dose distribution and the possibility of geographic miss as a result of poor treatment planning. In preclinical assays involving tumors, typically one wants to know what the TD50 is, or the tumor dose 50. This is the number of cells which have to be injected in order for a tumor to form in 50% of mice. Typically 50% will grow from inoculum sizes in the order of 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4 cells. This is a fairly large number, and it introduces the concept that in order for tumor to grow, they must have stem cells within the inoculum, and that these stem cells are relatively rare within tumors. The cancer stem cell hypothesis suggests that these clonogenic stem cells in a tumor are critical for regrowth and for accelerated repopulation during radiation therapy. So it's important to know the radiation resistance of these cells or the resistance to other therapies. It's obviously critical to eliminate stem cells, much more critical than it is to eliminate non-stem cells. There are a number of recent studies which have looked at the radiation response of stem cells, and this study from Frank Pajonk and colleagues in our lab shows that stem cells from breast cancer cell line MCS7 are markedly more radiation resistant than non-stem cells, and if one treats populations of cells with radiation repeatedly in a fractionated protocol, one finds that in fact there is selection for these relatively radiation resistant stem cell populations. In order to look at the response to radiation therapy, this can be done in a number of different ways. One way is to inject tumor cells and irradiate locally whenever they get to a certain size, and look at the dose of radiation that is needed to cure 50% of mice. With this assay, you find that there's a threshold sigmoid curve, which goes from about 10% tumor cure to 90% over about a range of the equivalent of 10 gray in a clinical fractionation scheme. So this is a very steep tumor control probability curve. Obviously, in order to cure an animal or a person of a tumor, the last surviving clonogen must be killed. And even then, this is a probability function of dose. So the tumor control probability is equal to e to the minus x, where x is the number of surviving clonogenic stem cells. So if you have 100 tumors, and the number of surviving clonogenic stem cells is on average 1, then the tumor control probability is 37%. Another way of looking at this is to say e to the minus x is equal to e to the minus m times sf, where n is the initial number of clonogens, and sf is the surviving fraction. If you use this formula, then you can see that the surviving fraction after 2 gray radiation could be a big determiner. You can use this to look at this parameter, and here we have tumor control probability curves for tumors with 10 to the 9 clonogenic cells. Assuming that the surviving fraction at 2 gray is 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6, and 0.7. If the surviving fraction is low, then you've got a good probability or a good chance of curing a patient. If the surviving fraction is high, then you've got very little chance. Obviously, in a group of patients, one can have a large variation in tumor clonogen number. If this is the case, the tumor clonogen number, let's say, varies from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 11, then the tumor control probability curves will be an average of those individual tumor control probability curves. It will be a lot flatter than what one would expect theoretically, or what one might find experimentally. Typically, clinical tumor control probability curves can be very flat, and this is due to the heterogeneity between different tumors and between patients. Another way of looking at this issue is to consider what happens with micrometastatic disease, where the tumor number might vary from 1 to 10 to the 9, or 10 to 10 to the 8. Under these kind of circumstances, this would give a very flat tumor control probability curve. It also suggests, however, that if you use very low doses of radiation, then you might be able to decrease the chances of metastasis growing, because it would be possible to eliminate very small metastatic burdens. So in fact, the tumor control probability curve for micrometastatic disease is more linear than curvilinear. Whenever we start thinking about how tumors grow and how they regress following radiation therapy, the kinetics of this process really has to be taken into account. And there are three major factors influencing the kinetics. The first is cell cycle, the second is the growth fraction, and the third is the cell loss factor. Cell cycle we've already talked about previously. The growth fraction could be taken, if you like, as the proportion of proliferating cells within a tumor, or the number of clonogens for that matter. It can be considered as equal to P upon P plus Q, where P is the number of proliferating cells and Q the number of non-proliferating cells. The cell loss factor, also known as phi, measures the loss of cells from a tissue. If the cell loss factor is zero, then the actual volume doubling time of a tumor is the same as the potential volume doubling time of the tumor, assuming that this, of course, there is no cell loss, which is the confounding influence which discriminates the actual volume doubling time from the potential volume doubling time. So the cell loss factor, therefore, is equal to 1 minus T pot upon TD if the growth factor fraction is 1 and all the cells are proliferating. Then the potential doubling time, or volume doubling time, is the same as the cell cycle time, which is the same as the actual volume doubling time. The cell loss factor is important because on the steady state conditions, one thinks that there is a constant cell number maintained by the balance between cell proliferation and cell loss. In other words, phi is equal to 1. In tumors or in embryos, phi is in fact less than 1. In other words, it grows. The importance of these different parameters can be seen by an example. Taken from human squamous cell carcinoma, estimates of cell cycle time might be in the order of 36 hours. If we have a growth fraction of 25%, then the potential doubling time of this tumor is 4 by 36 hours, or 6 days. So this is a very rapid potential doubling time. Now, obviously, tumors don't double at that rate, and when one looks at the actual volume doubling time, it's more likely to be in the order of 60 days. This means the cell loss factor is 0.9. The rate of tumor growth and the rate of tumor regression, therefore, after therapy, are determined largely by the cell loss factor rather than the cell cycle time. And this varies greatly from tumor to tumor. It follows that slowly growing tumors may regress very rapidly, and that slow regression in itself is not an indication of treatment failure. On the other hand, rapidly growing tumors might be expected to regress and regrow rapidly. So in general, the rate of tumor regression after treatment is not prognostic of outcome, and one has to be very careful in how you interpret the disappearance of a tumor. Some classic studies done back in the 1960s and 1970s indicated the importance of tumor regeneration in terms of the response to radiation. For example, this study by Hermans and Berenson showed that if rat tumors were irradiated, then there was a decrease in their size, and this then they would then increase in size again after an appropriate growth delay period. However, if they actually looked in vitro at the number of surviving clonogens at different times after radiation, they found that this increased with time, as shown in the bottom graph. Furthermore, this increase actually took place at the same time as the tumors were actually regressing. This was some of the first evidence in favor of the fact that radiation might actually induce a tumor to regenerate or repopulate. And this appears to depend also upon the extent to which the tumor is knocked down. So after high doses of radiation, one sees a much more rapid tumor regeneration process than after lower doses of radiation. This concept of accelerated repopulation has become very popular, and it accounts for a number of clinical observations. For example, after radiation therapy, tumors tend to recur faster than they would be expected based upon the original growth rate. Furthermore, if you do split course radiation therapy, it often gives poor results, indicating that something is happening during the break and that the tumor is rapidly repopulating. The same conclusion is reached if you protract the treatment time. And this process of accelerated repopulation has given a rationale for accelerated treatment, which has been shown at times to be of benefit. probably the most definitive study of clinical study of tumor repopulation. It comes from Makievsky and Withers. And this was done with T2, T3 squamous cell head and neck cancers. It indicated that if you look at the total dose required to achieve tumor control, then this increased as there was an increase in the overall treatment time. This could be formalized in a model which is on the right-hand side, which shows essentially that there's an onset of repopulation about 4 weeks after the start of radiation therapy, and this is followed by a period of accelerated repopulation where there is a 3 or 4 day doubling time. This implies that, in fact, if you're giving 2 gray fractions of radiation, you are losing about 0.6 gray per day to accelerated repopulation once the repopulation takes place. A more recent analysis by Makievsky is shown by the red line, and he suggests now that, in fact, the onset may be around day 21, and that repopulation may not be constant, but increases from about 0.6 gray per day about week 3 or 4 to in the order of 1.6 to 1.8 gray a day being lost around week 6 or 7. It would be nice to have a predictive assay to actually be able to assess whether in fact a patient should be put into an accelerated repopulation trial. It was thought that perhaps TPOT would be a good predictor of this response, but a large multicenter trial was unable to confirm it. However, it should be noted that the TPOT values that were obtained in this clinical trial, head and neck squamous cell, was in the order of 3 to 5 days for most patients, confirming that there was the potential there for very rapid growth of tumor. And this is consistent, of course, with the model that we proposed earlier. Whenever one considers the factors that are responsible for failure to achieve local control, then, as we've already said, the number of clonogenic stem cells and their intrinsic radiosensitivity and the kinetics of these cells is extremely important. But tumor microenvironments also must play a role. We tend to think in radiobiology largely of the oxygen effect whenever we think of the tumor microenvironment, though of course it is a lot broader than just oxygen. However, the early radiobiologists in particular, back in the 1930s to 1960s, people like Gray, Mottram, Flanders and Tomlinson, really laid the basis for the importance of oxygen in terms of tumor biology and response to therapy. We now think of tumor hypoxia as being due to two processes. One is the chronic hypoxia that is the result of limited oxygen diffusion into the tumor. The other is the acute or intermittent hypoxia, which is the result largely of chaotic vasculature and a high interstitial pressure. Chronic hypoxia is the classic form of hypoxia where oxygen is diffusing from a blood vessel, is used up by those cells which are closest to the blood vessel, and by the time one gets to 100 micrometers away from the blood vessel, there's insufficient oxygen to maintain cell viability. But between that area of incipient necrosis and the proliferative layers close to the blood vessel, there is an area of chronic hypoxia which might be only of the order of a few layers, cell layers thick, but which can be very important in terms of tumor response. It's important to realize that hypoxia is correlated more with the type of tumor rather than just the size of the tumor. In fact, hypoxia tends not to correlate with tumor volume. This chronic hypoxic state is really quite different from what we know as acute hypoxia. Acute hypoxia is thought to be due to the tortuous nature of blood vessels within tumors. These are structurally abnormal, and they are dilated, tortuous, they're elongated, and they have a very thin basement membrane with that is lacking in pericytes. Such vessels have increased permeability, and this gives rise to increased interstitial pressure. So this abnormal vasculature results in spatial and temporal heterogeneity in blood flow. Essentially, what this means is that these blood vessels open and close rapidly, and this produces temporary areas of acute hypoxia, acidity, and nutrient depletion. Classic studies by Hal Gray showed that oxygen was a very powerful oxidizing agent and radiosensitizer if it was present at the time of irradiation. The oxygen enhancement ratio is, however, found to be critically dependent upon oxygen tension, and there needs to be a very low partial pressure of oxygen assessed in terms of millimeters of mercury. Of in the order of less than 10 before one gets into what radiobiologically relevant hypoxic region. However, the oxygen enhancement ratio at higher than these areas is in the order of 2.5 to 3, and so this is a very significant effect. The oxygen enhancement ratio is dependent upon the indirect action of ionizing radiation and, of course, will decrease with high LET radiation. Whenever the LET reaches into the order of 100 to 125, 150 keV per micrometer, one ends up with a very low oxygen enhancement ratio. There are many ways in which you can demonstrate hypoxic regions within tumors. Differential radiation sensitivity is one. The Eppendorf polarographic electrode is another. And a third is really based upon the use of drugs, which are oxygen mimetics, which can be detected either by immunohistochemistry or by PET imaging. Differential radiation sensitivity was demonstrated in the early 1970s by people like Sarah Rockwell and Robert Kalman. What they did was they irradiated a tumor within on the leg or of an animal. After 24 hours, they made a cell suspension and performed a clonogenic assay in vitro. If the irradiated mice in three conditions, either breathing pure oxygen or under normal breathing air or with the leg clamped so the tumor became hypoxic, they showed they got three very different survival curves. Under hypoxic conditions, there was a much greater chance of cell survival than there was under air or under oxic conditions. Furthermore, what they showed was that whenever you're irradiated under normal ambient conditions, the curve took the shape of a dog leg. The initial slope was obviously the same as the initial slope on the oxic curve, and therefore they postulated that the end of the slope was really due to the presence of radiation-resistant hypoxic cells. And by extrapolating back onto the y-axis, they could work out the hypoxic fraction within a tumor. It was also possible to do studies with a normal tumor or with a leg clamp to induce hypoxia and look at the tumor control probability curves. And here you can see that under hypoxia, the tumor control probability has shifted fairly dramatically to the right. The introduction of the Eppendorf needle as an oxygen probe really was an important step forward, because it allowed multiple measurements to be made within a tumour, either in preclinical settings or in clinical settings. So you could measure the proportion of measurements that had low oxygen tension and express these in the form of some curve, rather like it's shown in the next slide. This, however, is a relatively invasive technique and has largely been replaced by the use of bioreductive drugs. Bioreductive drugs are like oxygen mimetics, but they penetrate much better than oxygen into hypoxic areas, where they will bind and form adducts in the vitro and in vivo with thiol groups in proteins, and this can be detected using, for example, a monoclonal antibody against the adducts that form. So misoniazole or pimoniazole are common bioreductive drugs, and F-Mizole PET is one of two commonly used PET tracers, the other being copper ATSN. There are other derivatives such as EF-5, which is a fluorinated derivative of etanidazole. All of these are more recent ways of being able to look at hypoxia within tumours. This is a picture from Bert van der Kogel showing just how the hypoxic cells are in this discrete area as measured by pimoniazole staining, which is distinct from the area of necrosis, distinct from the blood vessels stained in red, and distinct from the proliferating cells as assessed by uptake of iododeoxyuridine. Here is a slide showing that pimoniazole, again, is distinct from the vasculature in human head and neck tumour, and that areas of chronic hypoxia tend to stain much brighter than areas of acute hypoxia, but they also can be stained. An important aspect of hypoxia is that it is, in fact, a signal for a cell. It will activate a number of different transcription factors. AP1, NF-kappa-B, SP1 can mediate radiation resistance, as we noted in the last lecture. Another transcription factor that can be induced is P53, and P53 can cause apoptosis. Because of the fact that hypoxia-induced P53 can cause cell death, then obviously hypoxia can act as a selection factor for P53 mutations. So another transcription factor which is produced is HIF-1-alpha, and HIF-1-alpha has downstream products which are very important in terms of tumour cell behaviour. This includes VEGF, the angiogenesis factor, CA9, and osteopontin. How this works is that HIF-1-alpha is a target for hydroxylation by HIF-prolyl hydroxylase. This targets HIF-1-alpha for rapid degradation under normal conditions. However, on the hypoxia, the enzyme is inhibited, because it uses oxygen as a co-substrate. This means the HIF-1-alpha is stabilized, it binds the HIF-1-beta to upregulate many of the genes which are involved in promoting survival under low oxygen conditions, including glycolysis and VEGF. It might be thought that some of these downstream genes would be good surrogate markers for hypoxic status. However, in fact, there are many agents which will stabilize HIF-1, and although some of these markers have been shown to be fairly useful, they're really not definitive or gold standard markers. As I've said, the fact that hypoxia is an agent which will induce cell death through P53 dependent mechanisms Because this will lead to selection of cells with loss of p53 function, hypoxia will in fact indirectly confer resistance to radiation and other pro-apoptotic insults. It will trigger genetic instability by causing selection of p53 mutated cells. And it will also, of course, potentiate metastasis through inducing angiogenesis. Hypoxia-induced gene expression is therefore a relatively complex type of process. HIF-1-alpha production is generally maintained at the mRNA level, downstream of the receptor tyrosine kinase receptors. The HIF-1 protein is degraded very, very rapidly as soon as it's produced by the mechanism which I've already discussed. However, because hypoxia blocks this degradation process leading to HIF-1 stabilization, the target genes can be upregulated, leading to VEGF, IGF-2, and glucose transporters, which affect angiogenesis and metabolism. So HIF-1-alpha can actually be considered as the center of a universe which involves many important factors in terms of tumor cell behavior. The inflammatory cytokines, redox regulation, pH regulation, energy metabolism, cell proliferation, angiogenesis, and even cell death. The clinical relevance of tumor hypoxia is something that has been studied in some detail. There are many different types of sources of evidence for the existence of hypoxia and its importance in the clinic. For example, there are lots of rather anecdotal studies showing that hyperbaric chambers show benefit. Anemia has always been known to be a negative feature in terms of outcome. It's important to realize that in recent years erythropoietin has been administered to cancer patients on radiation therapy. In fact, erythropoietin has been shown to have a deleterious effect in head and neck squamous cell carcinoma because it, in addition to stimulating angiogenesis, also stimulates tumor cell growth, and in particular growth of cancer stem cells. Nitroimidazoles have been used in patients with immunohistochemistry and PET studies being done, and also microelectrode studies in a number of different labs have shown that hypoxia correlates with poor local response to radiation therapy and also with survival. So Norsmark has shown that hypoxia can impact local control in head and neck cancer, as has Dave Brazel. However, they also showed that it correlated with disease-free survival. And Hockel has shown that hypoxia correlates not with local invasion and survival, not only in cases treated with radiation, but also in cases treated only with surgery. And this again indicates that hypoxia is not a problem which is only restricted to radiation therapy. It's a problem which is inherent within cancer therapy in general, and that hypoxia is acting to drive tumor aggression. So the measurements that have been made using the Eppendorf polygraphic probe have clearly indicated that in many different types of cancers, there are low median PO2 levels, the fraction of radiobiologically relevant hypoxic cells tends to be relatively high. And this is the data from NORDSMARK showing that there is a difference in terms of tumor control with radiation therapy depending upon whether there was a small or a large hypoxic fraction. And this is the data showing disease-free survival in cervix cancer depending upon the median PO2 levels. And this exists irrespective of whether surgery or radiation therapy was the treatment modality. Obviously, the concept that hypoxia is important has led to the idea that perhaps oxygen mimetics might work as radiosensitizers, and that endogenous or exogenous thiols, which would scavenge oxygen, could lead to radioprotection of normal tissues. Radiosensitizers such as the nitromidazoles can certainly mimic oxygen and can fix damage in a way which is relatively similar to the way the oxygen is effective. In general, in the clinic, these studies have been associated with some level of toxicity, although there have been also some positive trials. Most notably, the trials that were positive have been those which have been come from Dahanka, or the Danish clinical radiation oncology group. So treatment with nimorazole resulted in increased local regional control from 34% to 49% in advanced squamous cell head and neck cancer. Hans Overgaard has recently done a meta-analysis which suggests that there is a significant improved survival and local regional control as a result of hypoxia modification. This is true in a number of different sites, though it really is only significant in head and neck cancer, the reason being that the number of patients who have been put on these may, in fact, have kind of biased the statistics in terms of favouring a statistically significant outcome in that particular disease situation. Hypoxia can also be thought of in terms of being a target for intervention in a different way, and this brings up the idea that there are or there might exist hypoxic cytotoxins, and the number of these have been looked at. The idea is here that these drugs will, under hypoxic conditions, be cytotoxic for hypoxic cells. Mitomycin C is one of these agents. There are nitro aromatics have been looked at, and also the benzotriazine dienoxides, such as tyrosine, have been put into clinical trials. Tyrosine got as far as phase 3 clinical trials with cisplat, and phase 2 trials with radiation therapy. It was taken off the market largely because of toxicity issues, although many investigators have suggested that, in fact, this approach is a reasonable one, in particular if one stratifies patients according to the extent of the hypoxia within their tumours. I think it is also reasonable to assume that, at least with fractionated radiation therapy, one might get reoxygenation during the course of treatment. And Putten and Kalman and others have demonstrated that this, in fact, does occur. But, in fact, the proportion of hypoxic cells present within a tumour really varies quite a lot, as does the response in terms of reoxygenation. So multiple mechanisms seems to exist and it's quite difficult to tease these one from the other. It's certainly true that angiogenesis is a very important part of cancer development. Angiogenesis is the process of making new blood vessels from pre-existing capillaries. And in general, once a tumor gets to greater than 1 millimeter in size, it requires a blood supply in order to keep on increasing. Angiogenesis, of course, occurs in many other normal physiological conditions, such as wound repair, pregnancy, and also during the menstrual cycle. There are various major steps in the angiogenic process which have been looked at in some detail. In order to develop new blood vessels, the basement membrane has to be degraded. The endothelial cells have to essentially invade the adjacent extravascular space. And the proliferating cells at the leading edge are continuously being replaced by non-proliferating cells which line the blood vessel. The influences which are responsible for the production of angiogenesis and new blood vessels really are again multiple. There are a large number of different cytokines which are involved. Factors like VEGF, FGF, PDGF, and so on are the major kind of angiogenic factors. This process is stimulated by hypoxia, as we said before, but also by carbon dioxide, by cyclooxygenase 2 and nitric oxide, as well as tumor suppressor genes and oncogenes. The importance of tumor vasculature and angiogenesis is indicated by the relationship between microvascular density and the probability of metastasis, relapse, free survival. And the likelihood of metastasis increases directly as the density of tumor-associated blood vessels increase. A different process, or one way in which one can target angiogenesis, is by trying to use agents which disrupt this process. Obviously, this is not really a cytotoxic therapy as such, but it certainly inhibits tumor cell growth. This anti-angiogenesis strategy should be distinguished from vascular targeting. Vascular targeting is the use of drugs which cause irreversible damage to established tumor-associated blood vessels with the induction of tumor necrosis. On the one hand, the anti-angiogenic process strategy is required to have chronic exposure to the drug, whereas vascular targeting is a more acute effect. The end result of and the advantages of vascular targeting are that thousands of tumor cells depend upon each blood vessel. So essentially, by damaging one endothelial cell or a few endothelial cells, in theory, one can initiate an avalanche of tumor cell death, as Julie Dennekamp calls it. The other advantage is that because cells are targeted, are actually in contact with the bloodstream, delivery is not normally a problem. And since endothelial cells are genetically stable and non-transformed, treatment-related resistance is less likely to emerge than it is with many other forms of therapy, which targets the tumor cells rather than the vasculature. So vascular targeting, angiogenesis targeting, all of these are certainly strategies which have come into the clinic in recent years and are important in terms of patient care, but also give us some indication of important factors in terms of tumor biology and the response to radiation therapy.